Writing is often a solitary practice, but a pair of Atlanta poets found a way around that. Paige Sullivan is an MFA student, and Andy Rogers is a PhD student, both at Georgia State. And they've spent the last year collaborating on a book of poetry. They're calling it Duets, and to help celebrate National Poetry Month, we invited them in to share their work and talk about what the project is all about. Andy says it began with a list.
So I had this spreadsheet of different titles that could possibly use for poems I wrote in the future, just from different places all over the internet, things I saw on magazines, phrases that came to me. And I sent it to Paige and said, we should try to take titles from this list and both write poems and see what happens. So once one person would choose a title and write a poem, then the other one would write with the same title. And the poems are very different. Sometimes they're kind of in conversation with each other, and sometimes they're totally different. But that's the project, and it's called Duets.
Yeah, so it's sort of like collaboration that happens individually, right? We write alone, we revise alone, but then we bring the pieces back together. And like Andy said, it's really interesting to see what conversation they have with each other. Thematically, I think a lot of them are similar, but our approaches to craft are definitely individual.
So I believe this is one of the first ones that we started looking at in terms of a title, but it took a little while for us both to write this poem.
Right.
And it's called The Breakup Cycle. So it's both about relationship breakups, but then, so in my poem, it becomes about decomposition and things like that. So we kind of take the titles and make them into, they have their own life by the time we're finished.
Yeah.
The Breakup Cycle. When you see something dead on the side of the road, you have to decide whether to look away or move closer. Inspect the smell of death head on. Analyze the pattern the ants make through feathers, fur, farming the marrow. The day you drove me home, you studied your reflection in the windshield. You felt about as safe to me as a gun with no empty chambers. Risky, without even the thrill of possibility I wouldn't end up dead, or worse, maimed. My disappointment bored a hole in the side of your face. I said all I could. What the hell? No question mark, nothing hanging in the air. I don't know, you said. I laughed. I reminded you where to turn, got my own suitcase out of the trunk, dropped it on my foot. I said, thanks for wasting my time. I shouldn't have, but I meant it then. I don't know why I asked you to come in or why you did. I don't know why I made little butterflies of my words, pitched them like paper airplanes. I don't know why I tried to make you make amends. My therapist told me grief is a cycle, that we respond to it naturally based on what's worked for us in the past. My sister told me the women in our family are cursed from my grandmother down, but only when it comes to men. I've never told either one, but shutting down is all that works. You keep trying to reach out to me now. I stare ahead, name my grief, number it. I think of all those griefs without names. I think of the lost, the dying. I think of the unknown dead on the side of the road, bodies being unmade even now, pulsing anthills riddled with bullets, paper planes.
And this is my version of the breakup cycle. One, I make a triangular house of cards, three of spades supporting 10 of diamonds with a base of an ace of hearts. But with an accidental exhale, it collapses to the floor like a wilt, impervious to more sun, more water, now a scatter of red, black, white leaves. Shuffle them around for the equation of exactly how your hand couldn't solve. Two, I sat on a couch for 5 hours in the cafe around the corner. I drank tea and orange juice as a child is made to do when sick. Faulkner sat on my lap, unwanted and untouched. Around the corner, in a pile on the sidewalk, some crushed banana peppers picked off a sandwich from Subway. And I kept walking because I could not be the one to throw them away.
And then The next poem in our series today is the title comes from that list, obviously, but it's a mirror phrase. So it's called Something Wanting, Wanting Something. And I don't really remember the origin of this. I just remember wanting to call a poem Something Wanting and then thinking wanting something kind of goes along with that. They go together. So here's my version of Something Wanting, Wanting Something. I'm giving up my old ways. I have to, now that I've finally seen us for what we weren't, paralleled by this young couple running, tattooed hands clasped tight in front of my rental car here in this crosswalk at Little Five Points. I'm going to sit here through this green light, because what is life if not a series of wasted opportunities? Like last summer, when I wanted to buy the new Sufjan album from Criminal Records, but didn't, and you and I stood here on the same corner, crossed in the same crosswalk, heading back to your car, hands in pockets, single file. You know me too well. You know that poverty has taught me fear, taught me not to spend. You know I would never buy a record if I thought I might not open it right away, finger and flip it until I fell asleep. But what is life if not a series of wasted opportunities, where every single opportunity is conjecture, where every chance is another record I haven't bought for fear of not listening to it enough, or for fear of warping it, or for fear of loaning it to someone and then never seeing him again. There's no name for it, this deep fear of myself, of my unintentional, persistent need to give in or up, to give the costliest of things away. I'm going to sit here in this turn lane through this green light and then the next, because what is life if not a series of wasted opportunities like this, the chance to sit with my grief as drivers pass, cursing on either side.
So something interesting about having a preset list of titles made it challenging for me, because most of the time I forget to even read the title of a poem when I'm reading, which is bad poet move. And so it was interesting for me to do this project because it was drafting and it was writing in a very different way than I was used to. So sometimes I would stall and wait to write one of these poems because I just had no idea what to say. And I wanted the work to feel, you know, as organic as possible. And so we were working on different ones this summer, and then one day something happened, and then suddenly I knew what I wanted to write about for this title. So my version of this poem has an epigraph from an Amy Bender novel called An Invisible Sign of My Own, and I'll read that first. Quote, "It's a fine art when you think about it. To quit well requires an intuitive sense of beauty. You have to feel the moment of turn right when desire makes an appearance. Here is the instant to be severed. Whack. This is the moment when quitting is ripe as a peach turning sweet on the vine. Something wanting, wanting something. Waiting for the train, I realized that I chose the bench by the platform corner where someone had decided to pee, reminding me of the night before when I walked home fuzzy drunk and a guy shouted from his car, "Hey, you're a beautiful girl, and remember that you're awesome." He said it because we all want something, always. You and I had parted ways hours before, after I curved my palm around your neck, fingers brushing the ends of your hair there, a split in opposite directions on the sidewalk. Call it my heart on my sleeve, call it unguarded, call it giving myself away, then call it what it is. I'm just someone that lost you, and I'm not the same, and I'm not better. The way you are willing to reconsider, to change, to eat oatmeal in the morning and quit coffee, quit things you love to be better, it breaks me, makes all of this seem like it could be the best sort of ruin I've tasted.
And then the last poem in our trio today is called Last Looks. And that phrase originates from the theater. So sometimes in the summers I do extras work. And before you go on the set, they say last looks, just to make sure everybody's looking like they're supposed to. And I thought about that phrase. I was trying to choose phrases that had the possibility of multiple interpretations. And so I was thinking that would be a good title to just kind of put in the list and see what happened with it, because it also made me think of deteriorating relationships, which was a theme that runs throughout this chat book, obviously. Yeah. So I wrote this poem in response to the end of a long-term relationship that was almost a decade. And I was dating a musician who put out a couple of records afterwards that kind of told his version of the story, which I felt was very unfair because I didn't get to tell my side. So that's kind of what I'm doing in this poem. So it's called Last Looks. So now you've laid the whole disaster out in song. How you drove me to the airport, kissed me goodbye. How, as I turned to go, something in my face foretold the end. What must have slipped the lyrics is the truth. 9 years of me strung out on wanting you, praying in the shower, on the floor, in the car, that one day I would wake up and I would not want you. The beauty of the truth is that it is that brutal. Your version is evasive, cloudy as illegible handwriting swirled through abandoned chalkboard dust. If you want facts, start with this. In 9 years, I watched a lot of people die. It just took a while to realize that I was not one of them. If you want the truth, start here. You never saw me again because you refused to pick me up at the airport. If another man came, clutching a bouquet, hell, I don't want to point any fingers, but there's something to that, a little substance where nothing else took root. And yet, the way you tell it, you had both eyes closed, and when you opened them, you were surprised. The way you tell it uses signs and symbols. Lips become thin messengers of the unspoken, eyes a narrative device. The way you tell it uses chords, ignores years of discord. The way you tell it is artful. It is lovely, but it is not true. Only I know the sound the gate made as it closed. Only I know the perfected shower lean of the fervent, heartless, unanswered prayer. There's more truth in being unanswered than you can inject now in this retelling in which you are the victim, in which people moved past us in the terminal, all too human as we kissed, and I turned and took that last hard look at you. When I landed in London, I grabbed my small blue bag, took the yellow line straight to the extended stay hotel. I took the lift up to the third floor, stumbled numbly in and out of the shower in a jet-lagged haze, and I forgot to pray.
So I like that this phrase, last looks, comes from theater and, I guess, film, cinema, whatever you want to call it, because my interpretation of those words was very literal. The last look someone gives you and you give someone. And I think that's definitely connected to how we learn sort of the script of courtship and romance and love, and also the things that we remember, we're sort of, I guess, primed to remember, and maybe even a little bit haunted by how things begin and how things end. And for me, that was definitely the case. So this was another title where I read it and knew exactly what I would focus on, which was sort of a last look and the circumstances surrounding that. So last looks. You didn't want my dirty windows or the hair on the rug, but when the cat jumped into your lap, you stroked its throat and it surrendered itself into closing its eyes, slowing its breath. It was nice when we could sit across from each other like real people do, but no one wants to hear another woman say she loved a man so much that it broke her, and there's little justice in giving you what you want as you leave, me watching. You started to believe that the only people who could be happy were the ones not smart enough to feel any other way. But we practiced finding it. The place with poutine, the place with bad burritos, the cafe with the best chairs for our backs. I'd let you spill beer on my floor again, and soup, and the cat's water. You like match strikes for the smell, not the flame that eats the wood. And I know an ending when I see it, even when it smiles. So one thing I learned in this process, I guess just to be completely frank, we both started writing this when we were pretty angry. And that's just the truth. Some of that is very justified anger. And I think some of it is just the natural anger of being a human and wanting something and not getting what you want. And I think as a woman, it's always been tough for me to feel angry. And a word that kept coming into my head when I was working on these poems was bitter. Women are often described as bitter when they are angry, which sort of, invalidates your anger in a way, which made me more angry. And so I learned, we've revisited these poems again and again, reading them for live audiences or revising them on our own. And I definitely have gained a sense of distance and a necessary objectivity to the subject matter. And so I can see things kind of for what they are, which is really helpful. But I think that anger was necessary. And then it was also necessary to not be angry anymore. But both of those were equally needed and valid.
That's something I've really kind of taken from it, is that you can kind of use your work in a cathartic way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the idea of bitterness came up for me a lot, too.
Yeah.
I didn't want to come off as bitter. And I think in reading them aloud, you start to realize more the perception or how people are interpreting them. And as we've read them aloud more and more, we've continued to edit them. I think, I took a lot away from this project. I think the biggest thing I took away from it is how amazing collaboration can be, especially when you feel like you can't be creative when you're in a dark place or whatever, that you can start something with someone and just watch it grow. And that kind of takes over the empty space or something. I know that sounds corny, but.
No, I was just talking about this with a friend from our program who's a fiction writer. And we were talking about writing personal essays, memoir, things like that. And there's a really big pitfall of a lot of that kind of writing is that you say, essentially in a story or an essay, this happened to me, the end. And it's basically just a story you tell over coffee, and it's hard to make it universal. Why would an audience care about that? And so I think when you're doing something like we're doing, which is writing about very personal subject matter, there's a really great temptation, because there is an element of catharsis or therapy or whatever you want to call it, to that writing process, is to essentially say, hey, this happened to me, the end. And so I think the important thing that we've been doing now, since it's been about a year since we started, is going back and saying, okay, this happened. Now, how do we make it art? How do we bring craft into it? That's where the poetry comes in, I think.